online at bbc.co.uk/5live. This is the UK's home of live news and live sport. 5 Live.
Mark Kermode, good afternoon to you.
How are you going?
How are you enjoying your second test match?
It was very strange being in the second arena, because the first one when I was there with the Barmy Army, it really was like a rollerball crowd. And then the next one, it was much more what I expected. You know, people sitting around applauding gently and, you know, appreciating rather than the full... And, you know, when Ken Clark said the fat lady isn't singing yet, well, in the Barmy Army thing, the thing they were complaining about was that the guy with the trumpet wasn't allowed to play.
Are you enjoying it?
Yes.
Can you imagine coming to a test match out of choice?
Well, it's the
paying.
It is a genuinely strange experience. And actually, yeah, it's been really good fun, which I am surprised by, because you know what I know about sport wouldn't fill the back of a postage stamp. But it has been really good and very strange.
And now, I'm delighted to say we've been joined by George Romero, Hollywood legend. He's got a new movie out, and it's at the Frightfest Film Festival. George Romero, good afternoon to you.
Hello.
Hi there. This is now going to be a unique combination of live cricket and horror. What do you know about cricket, George?
Not very much. I'm American baseball. You know, Pittsburgh Pirates fan.
There is a very famous EC comic strip which ends with a baseball game played by zombies,
yes,
using severed limbs for
limbs for bases.
Absolutely.
I think somebody's heart was used as home base. I don't remember, but
that's right. Yeah.
That's the stuff. I grew up on that stuff, and it always gives me a giggle, you know. So George,
our conversation will be interrupted by a bouts of applause and cheering and that kind of thing, and we'll explain why people are cheering and applauding as we go through.
Let people think they're cheering for me. That's all right.
Okay, so all the applause you hear is for George A. Romero, who has his next zombie movie out. It's called Land of the Dead. Tell us about this particular movie, George.
Well, I've made three other zombie films earlier, Night of the Living Dead, Dawn of the Dead, and Day of the Dead, and I'm sort of back with my buddies, you know. It's a as the crowd...
Yep, the crowd are thrilled that the fourth in the quadrilogy has come in, and that's what they're cheering for.
That's what they're cheering for.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is the fourth of your zombie movies.
Yeah.
So why have you decided to make another one, George?
Well, I'll keep making them as long as I'm standing, you know. They're actually, I don't think of them as scary films necessarily. They're action adventure, and my stuff is known for its gore, which is probably, you know, something that comes from those EC comic books. And it's a platform that I can keep coming back to, and what underlies my films, I hope that people recognize, is their, you know, sort of a socio-political context. They're really snapshots of the time, of the decade that in which they were made.
So which aspects of this decade have you picked on to make sort of some kind of socio-political commentary from?
Well, I think some people might recognize, you know, Bush or Cheney or Rumsfeld in Dennis Hopper's character.
and tell us what Dennis Hopper does.
He's the villain of the piece. He's basically runs the administration, and it's, you know, it's my way or the highway, you know, attitude. And he's, you know, he keeps the sort of working classes in their place. And you know, if you don't agree with his policies, you're out of luck. So, I mean, there's a bunch of that in there. And there are images that are called up from the immediately pre-9/11 and post-9/11, this new normal that's in the United States now. There's a...
Do your zombies behave in a different way to the way zombies have traditionally played in your films? We've seen zombies running recently. Was it 24 hours, Mark?
They're not. This is very crucial. In 28 days later, 28 they're days, not yeah. zombies. They're infected. This is very important.
Right.
They're infected. It's a technical difficulty, but you know, for somebody like me who wrote for Fangoria for 5 years, it's very important. They're not zombies. They're infected. Whereas what George Romero's films are, they're definitely zombies. They are the ambulant dead.
Okay, so can your zombies for example, George?
Well, in the remake of Dawn, they ran. I just don't, it's just not my thing. You know, I think that my guys tried to run, their ankles would snap. And I, you know, I always joke. I'm sort of trying to evolve them more mentally and societally.
Well, they're zombies. How can you develop them mentally?
Well, it's starting with remembered behaviors. I mean, I had a zombie in the last film that had exhibited some anger and sadness and
affinity for music.
Yeah.
Well, and so the zombies, they're not as bad as they used to be.
No, they're not. I'm switching allegiance. I've always, you know, I always sympathize with the monsters, you know. I mean, Frankenstein's monster was, you know, I sympathize with him. King Kong, you know, Godzilla, friend of children. To me, the monster is always the, you know, just a guy that's, you know, drew the short straw, you know, and has a problem and is basically misunderstood. So that's the way I treat these guys. I mean, I find them. There's a character in the new film, in Land of the Dead. I think there's a zombie character who I think is the most noble of the characters in the film. But anyway,
a noble flesh-eating zombie.
Yeah.
You're simplifying them by saying that. I mean, I'd like to jump in here and say every great horror fan loves, you know, Night of the Living Dead, which incidentally I do think is one of the scariest films ever made. Dawn of the Dead, which is a fantastic look at consumerism. It's very arch, very funny, very strange, very, very gory. And Day of the Dead, which is to some extent about vivisection and is also about the zombies having proper characters. And as with so many great horror filmmakers, as George was saying, what you're fascinated in is that you sympathize with the beast. And of course, in Land of the Dead, actually, some of the zombies are easily the most sympathetic character, to the point that as the movie goes on, we discover some kind of resolution between the live character and the dead character. Now, oddly enough, Shaun of the Dead, whose makers, as you probably know, are absolutely in love with George Romero's movies.
And George Romero's in love with them.
Yeah, you like Shaun of the Dead,
I'm wearing my Furry Electric badge right now that they gave me. I mean, well, I love that. We've started to hang out. They actually came to B's, but Simon Pegg and Edgar Wright came to B Zombies in Land
That's
of the
right,
Dead.
Yeah.
Well, you remember at the end of Shaun of the Dead, the punchline of it is actually that the dead end up living with the living and they all learn to live together in harmony. And oddly
right.
enough, there is something of a move towards that in Land of the Dead. I have to say that, you know, as a horror fan, I think, you know, George Romero is a living legend, and I think it's a real privilege to have you on the show.
Well, thank you so much. That's great. And I'm trying to, you know, I don't know. I don't know how long I'm going to live, so I have to put that little wink in there. You know, there needs to be some sort of détente, you know. You don't eat me and I won't shoot you.
Here's a question from Simon Richardson. Says, George, what is your opinion of the Italian zombie movie genre that largely grew out of exploiting Dawn of the Dead?
You know, I loved some of Fulci's stuff. I find most of them a little vacant. I have this thing that I just need to... I use these films as a way of reflecting, you know, the climate of the times, and I don't see that very often. So,
how does one get to be a zombie in your films, George?
You get killed.
Oh, no,
you
no,
get bitten.
I don't mean, you know, within the film. I mean,
oh, you mean in the real world?
Yeah. Do you have your favorite actors in there? I mean, how do you get to be a zombie?
Well, you know, when I was shooting them in Pittsburgh, and then you could bring in all your friends and buddies and family, and that was great fun. But this film was shot in Canada, and the union situation. It was only days when there were 65, you know, paid union extras that we could bring in. You know, that you could bring in your son. Pretty much, I have never had a problem. It's sort of everyone in the world wants to come and be a zombie. I've had rock bands call me up and authors, and I mean, it's everybody wants to be a zombie, and they want to you know have a grisly makeup, and they want to get to eat somebody, and you know it's amazing how many people are into this stuff.
Well, George, the next time you need a slightly paunchy Elvis lookalike zombie in one of your movies, please give me a ring.
Okay, Elvis, man. Elvis should be among the dead. Well, I don't know. Maybe he's among the living.
Well, I think, don't even go there, because
I don't know what a difficult subject that is for Mark. You genuinely believe that Elvis was still alive for many years after he'd clearly passed away.
He had moved into another realm, thank you.
George, it's been good talking to you.
Oh,
I appreciate
it's been
your time.
Thank you very much.
And
I appreciate that you brought all these people to cheer for me here.
That's right. In fact, if you listen very carefully, they're just starting to sing the national anthem for no apparent reason.
There's only one George Romero.
That's what they're actually singing. George, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, George Romero on 5 Live. Now, the last time Mark and I went to a test match, it was up at Durham, as I was talking about
right,
earlier,
yeah.
And you had the rules of cricket explained to you by Mike Gatting.
By Mr. Batting.
Yeah, and confused everybody. And by the time he'd finished, no one had the... including Pat Murphy.
Including him.
Had absolutely no idea how this game was played. So
yeah.
I think as we have the great Alex Stewart here, I mean, maybe you could just... I mean, maybe Mark has progressed in his understanding of cricket in the two intervening years.
Well, I'd like to think so, Mark, because once you sampled Durham and that wonderful test match only lasted two and a bit days.
Yes.
Leading
scorer yourself.
Modes of dismissal, I'm going to ask you.
Tell what does that mean in English? Modes of dismissal means
how
what?
You get
how
out.
Could you be out at cricket?
How could you be out at cricket? You can be bowled out.
Excellent.
You can be caught out if you hit the ball and somebody catches it before it hits the floor.
Very, very impressive.
You can be stumped if you come out of the crease and the guy behind it, you know, I want to call him the backstop, but he's actually the wicketkeeper, isn't it?
You're better than good.
You can be... leg before wicket.
Oh,
if the ball hits and it's going towards the wicket, I know that. You can be run out if you don't manage to get into the when you're doing the running and they throw the ball and hit the what's it. You can be timed out if when they change over the batsman, you've got 3 minutes to change the batsman
now
over.
You'd
and
be,
if you don't
you'd
do
be
it,
looking this up now.
You can.
I'm impressed.
You can be out for obstructing a member of the field. It's called like obstructing the game or something. You're getting in where you're trying to get there. You can be out for hitting the ball twice deliberately, unless, of course, it's rolling back towards the wicket. In which case, obviously, naturally, you can do that.
Belief has crashed now. We just don't believe any of that.
Mark, I'll give you the tip.
You can be out for hitting your own. Sorry, go on.
Before you came on air,
yes,
Simon told me that you know absolutely nothing about the game of cricket. Having listened to you now for the last minute and a half, you are an expert. Pat Murphy, watch out.
Well, I've been trained by the best.
You haven't even finished it, and you can be out for... You were going to do one more.
Hitting the wicket.
Has he done the whole lot?
10.
He's just about there.
That was 10. There's 10 ways. Yeah. 10. Oh, no, I didn't. I said 9. I didn't say handling the ball.
You were
I
about
did say
to,
handling
though,
the ball.
You were yes. about to. I'd
you can,
help
you can
out
touch the ball with your foot, but not with your hand.
I'm very disappointed now. The whole point of bringing is that you don't.
The
know
gag's gone sour. Hasn't
it has.
It? Ha!
I think what we should do.
Can you now do 10 ways to kill a zombie? Bet you can't.
There's only one. You just get them in the head.
Yes. Oh, that's right. Actually, yes. Well
okay.
done.
So there is
that
just
is
the
it.
One. Okay. The applause, Pat Murphy.
Brett Lee thought he had the final wicket there. He angled the ball in at the left-handed Simon Jones, and he thought it'd gone from Jones's body onto the stumps and dislodged the bail, but not so. The crowd enjoyed that. So the Brett Lee is a good showman, good extrovert, and he's enjoyed the banter this summer. The ball actually hit the stumps, and unbelievably, Alec, I can't believe there's enough force there from that ball to dislodge the bails. Didn't happen. Have you seen that before? It's amazing.
Well, you have seen, but Brett Lee bowls it around 90 mile an
exactly.
hour. You'd expect the ball to knock the bails
so
off there,
so
but
it's hit the wicket.
Well, it's hit him on the shoulder, onto the head, roll back, bounce against the base of the stumps, and the bails weren't dislodged.
At least one bail has to come off, you see, Simon.
And Mark knew all this, didn't you?
Yeah, because he could have actually used his bat again to stop the ball, you know, or maybe his foot, but not to push it out.
Mark, I think Richie Beno needs to look out.
I think he does.
A nation yawns. And there's a shot from Jones looking for the straight drive. Didn't get any joy with that one. Stopped by
okay.
the foot of the bowler.
Before the nation continues to yawn, we'll take some news and we'll take some news and sport, and then we'll have some movie reviews as well, which hopefully will neatly coincide with tea. The Dukes of Hazzard, No Entry, Summer Storm, The Adventures of Shark Boy, Lava Girl in 3D seems one of the
Adventures of Shark Boy and Lava Girl
oh, Shark
in 3D.
Boy. Oh, right. Is that a 15?
No, it's a U.
Oh, OK. Well, it could have gone either way, couldn't it, really? Also, this bizarre thing, The Sisterhood of the Travelling Pants, which is an extraordinary movie, which is out, and all those reviews to come. Your comments welcome. mayo@bbc.co.uk. 5 Live at Trent Bridge. It's 3:31.
141 for 5, and Peter's now early in that first session this morning. England would more than settle for this, Simon.
If we were casting this as a Hollywood movie, some of your suggestions. Warren would be played by Val Kilmer. Flintoff by Ewan McGregor with Trainspotting haircut and Lancashire accent, hopefully. That's Jake in Knott sending that one. Yoda from Star Wars would play Ricky Ponting. I'm not sure that that's fair. Tom Hanks is Michael Vaughan, according to David and Sophia. And Matthew from Hexham, I'd cast Johnny Depp and Kevin Costner in it so that my mum would just take an interest in cricket all of a sudden. And Stephen Beresford, or possibly Steve Beresford, Paul Bettany for Freddie Flintoff.
Well, Paul Bettany for absolutely anybody, frankly.
Yeah, well, he could just about do it.
Yeah, I think that Michael Vaughan looks more like Jason Patrick.
Yes.
You know, the high forehead and the...
Isn't his nickname Virgil, one of his nicknames, as in Thunderbird?
Because of the high forehead?
Yeah.
Who else would you cast, Mark? I know you had a few ideas.
Well, they passed the... I mean, obviously, now that I'm so knowledgeable about him... Now, look, how do you pronounce that?
Grant Jones.
Him. Matt Damon. Clearly Matt Damon. Look, cutesy, smiley.
All right, any others?
Yeah, him.
Glenn McGrath.
Either Mel Gibson... Only
well,
younger.
30 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. Or Tim Roth, but again, probably 30 years ago.
Jason Gillespie? Billy Connolly.
Or Bill Bailey.
Bill Bailey, maybe.
Yeah.
Okay, you're suggesting for Shane Warne?
Sean Bean. You don't think? I think he looks like Sean Bean.
Okay.
No?
All your suggestions welcome. mayo@bbc.co.uk. The big movie of the week is Dukes of Hazzard. That's what all the posters are about. I used to detest the TV series with a passion. Will I like the film anymore?
Well, you remember the TV series started in 1979, but was largely an 80s phenomenon. Unbelievably ran for 6 series and apparently 147 episodes.
Every one of them awful.
And the story is there's a couple of guys, they're cousins, they drive around Hazzard County in a rubbish 1969 orange Dodge Charger with a Confederate flag on the top of it. And every now and then they stop and talk to Daisy, who wears a pair of short shorts and falls over, and they get in and out of trouble with the litter. Hilarious. You know, idea, the comic potential of which was completely exhausted by the end of episode 1. But they did have 6 series. Now, of course, it's a big mainstream movie starring Johnny Knoxville and Sean William Scott, who's that guy, who's the annoying one out of the American Pie movies. Remember we had Jason Biggs on? Witty. I mean, basically, we said, you know what's going to happen now? Yeah, what's going to happen now is that every 3 minutes we're going to have a shot of the undercarriage of that Dodge Charger leaping into the air. Oh, how it leaps over absolutely everything, because that's pretty much the most exciting thing that happens in the Dukes of Hazzard. I mean, it is absolute rubbish from start to finish. It doesn't surprise me, for example, that Johnny Knoxville and Sean William Scott are in it, because fine, that's what they do. Their sort of shucks, yee-haw, faux country shtick is what they sort of do. Jessica Simpson apparently is a top recording artiste. You probably know more about that than I do.
Well, yeah, she is. I don't know a lot about her, but no. She is a top recording artiste.
Right, well, she wanders around in a pair of hot pants, and that's it.
That's what you have to do.
Yeah, Willie Nelson's in it. Now, that's really, really... really depressing. Willie Nelson is a fantastic, you know, country
cash
western
flow.
Legend. Do you think that's... Well, I mean, it's clearly not for artistic things. It's clearly not, he thought, you know, after doing all those classic recordings like that brilliant version of Always On My Mind, which is even better than the Presley version, what I'll do is I think I'll make Dukes of Hazzard because I really need that. He's in a scene with Linda Carter, who used to be Wonder Woman. Remember that? And she's better than him, probably because she has less to lose than he does. And the bad guy is played by Burt Reynolds. Now, luckily for Burt Reynolds, the thing is meant to be a comedy, but there aren't actually any laughs in it, which is really handy, because if Burt Reynolds laughed, his entire face would snap off and give him some kind of terrible whiplash injury. I mean, it is just unbelievably pure. And I was watching it thinking, was the TV show really this bad? And then, of course, they've released all the TV... Yeah, well, they've released all the TV shows on DVD. And you have to watch 5 minutes of them to go, yeah, the TV show was every bit as bad as this. It's moronic, it's dumb, it's stupid. Well, fine. There are movies that are those things that are also funny. But crucially, it's boring. It's directed by this guy, Jay Chandrasekhar, who the thing that he was responsible before was a movie called Club Dread, which I've seen, and I swear I cannot tell you whether it was a horror movie or a comedy, because I don't know whether the awfulness of it was deliberate or parodic or just that it was one of the worst movies I'd ever seen in my life. I mean, it is staggeringly bad. It's so bad that yesterday my kids, against my better judgment, said that they wanted to go and see Fantastic Four, which I didn't like very much. And we went to our local cinema to go and see Fantastic Four, and it wasn't, you know, they got the times wrong and it wasn't showing, and they had on a preview of the Dukes of Hazzard. So I was saved from having to see Fantastic Four again by the fact that the Dukes of Hazzard were on. But I thought, actually, I would rather do anything. I would rather see Fantastic Four than watch the Dukes of Hazzard, because I didn't subject Dukes of Hazzard, my kids, to the Dukes of Hazzard, because who would? I mean, it's just complete garbage from beginning to end, and it's hopefully will be the final nail in the coffin of people doing all these TV spin. You know, we don't... And Bewitched, at least with Bewitched, the original TV show was kind of funny, and the Efron sisters did something kind of entertaining with it, although actually basically a bit rubbish, but, you know, at least they tried. In the case of the Dukes of Hazzard, they haven't tried at all. They've just thrown a whole bunch of money at it. And like I said, every 5 minutes, it's like nothing's happening. I know, let's see the underside of the car. It's the kind of film...
Or the underside of Jessica Simpson.
Exactly. The undercarriages are on display all the way through. It is aimed at audiences who laugh at roadkill. I mean, it's really, presumably it'll play, you know, very big in places with staggeringly low expectations of, you know, anyone who would just be amazed by the idea of a moving image on a screen with synchronized sound would be impressed by it. But beyond that, it's just a total stiff.
I haven't done the movie top 10, which because we were so excited by the end of the English innings. 477, by the way, if you just joined us here at Trent Bridge. England all out for 477. They are taking tea with a rhythmic beat in the background. The top 10 movies this week at 10, War of the Worlds.
It's still in the top 10, hanging in. And I would like to say that it turns out that I was right in that case. It was actually a perfectly decent film. Certainly Spielberg's best movie for a long time. And all that sort of antsy critical response when it came out was completely misjudged. It's a very good B movie.
Fantastic Four at 9.
It's rubbish.
It's rubbish, but not as rubbish as Dukes of Hazzard.
But then, you know, slamming your finger in a car door isn't quite as bad as Dukes of Hazzard.
Wedding Crashers at 8.
Funny for 15 minutes, and then not funny, or at least not as funny as it ought to be, for the remaining 90 minutes, which is a shame. I mean, again, I refer to Jason Biggs being on. If you're going to make one of those dumb comedies, make American Pie. Make a movie that doesn't have character development in it. Make a movie in which it's a bunch of guys making jokes about being a bunch of dumb guys. Don't try and expand the envelope. You don't need to. It's a dumb schmuck comedy.
Madagascar, or Madagascar, as they say in the movie, 7.
Yeah, well, I liked it enough. My kids absolutely loved it. And they sing that I Like to Move It song over and over again. And clearly the best voice artiste in it is our very own Ali G. What's his real name?
Sacha Baron Cohen. Your former schoolmate, as I recall.
Well, he was at the school I went to, but I don't think I ever met him.
Unleashed at 6.
Well, I apparently like this more than most people. I mean, it's completely silly. Jet Li is Bob Hoskins' dog. And Bob Hoskins has a collar on him, and when he takes the collar off, Jet Li beats everyone up.
Can
and then
imagine
he puts the collar
selling
back on
that
again
to whoever paid for it?
Well, yes, I can. Funnily enough, I can imagine being in a room with producers when that's an absolutely brilliant idea. Here, have $20 million.
That's 6. Herbie Fully Loaded at 5.
You could barely say that, could you? Like me, you were choked up by the idea of Herbie coming back. You know, I know it's not Citizen Kane, and I know, actually, it's probably fairly limp. Why is there a huge chorus going on in the background?
The PA system.
No, there's a man on the pitch singing, isn't there?
No, I don't think so. There are men on the pitch, but none of them are singing.
Okay.
It's just being played over the tannoy.
Well, I cried all the way through Herbie Fully Loaded. I thought it was really sweet, and, it is what it is, and it's not going to win any awards, but I thought it was perfectly fine.
Wider still and wider, shall thy bounds be set? God who made thee mighty, make thee mightier yet.
Are you reading it off a cue card?
They're showing it on the screen, and they're singing Land of Hope and Glory.
Okay, fine.
Just thought I'd
Land
mention that in case you're wondering what on earth is going on. Crash at 4.
Which I like very much, and I like the David Cronenberg Crash, and I think actually that the two movies are good companion pieces to each other. Again, people are being very sniffy about Crash, saying it's contrived. It's a drama. You know, not everything has to look like a Ken Loach film. It's a drama. It's a parable. It's a fable. You know, get a life.
Just the idea of movie reviews and Land of Hope and Glory full pelt.
I think I should have
Rich
this
PA
in the background
system.
Every time
That's
I do the reviews. I think it's completely right.
The Island at 3.
Well, you know, it's a big-budget remake of a perfectly decent 1979 horror movie called The Clonus Horror, which is unacknowledged, which I think is shameful.
Bewitched at 2?
You know, when I reviewed it last week, I said it was rubbish. Now, in the light of Dukes of Hazzard, I realise that it is, in fact, Battleship Potemkin.
Everything is comparative. Yes. Charlie and the Chocolate Factory is still the UK's
number. Loved it. If you've got kids, take them to see it. If you don't have kids, go and see it yourself. I mean, it's really good. It's a very good companion piece to the Gene Wilder version, and I thought it was great.
We're going to do another chorus. Quick, Deborah, bring us some travel. 12 to 4. It's 10 minutes to 4 at Trent Bridge. I think there is someone actually on the pitch leading the singing. Land of Hope and Glory is finished.
Yeah.
Oh, and he's off again. Jolly good. So with interesting operatic accompaniment, what else is that, Mark?
Okay, I'm going to describe a movie to you, and you tell me which movie I'm describing. A bunch of people go down a large hole. They lower themselves into a large pothole because they are enthusiastic potholers. Sadly, there's a rock fall, and they all get caught in the large hole. They realize that the only way out is to keep on going down. So they keep on going down, and the group dynamics all get very fractious. But then it turns out that living in the hole into which they have gone on down, there are strange mutated beasties that have been there for hundreds and hundreds of years living underground that start picking off the troop. Clearly,
Sound of Music.
No. Clearly, it's The Descent, right? The fabulous British horror movie that was, I think, cost like £3.5 million to make, directed by Neil Marshall, which is really, really terrific, and I think is, you know, one of the best British horror movies
I've seen
for a very long time.
Excuse me, I'm just going to see if we can shut the window here at Trent Bridge, because, I mean, I like the odd bit of opera. There he goes.
Is that Nessun Dorma?
He's taken a little bit out of it, but anyway, carry on.
Okay, yeah. So clearly that is the terrific British horror movie,
The Descent. I was just going to get to that.
Except it isn't. It's the not-so-great American-German co-production called The Cave, stars Cole Hauser, has a slightly more upmarket cast. Clearly they had more money, the sets are bigger, there's some underwater photography, and underwater photography is, you know, notoriously difficult to do and expensive. And in the press notes, they all talk scientifically about how, oh, well, there were these caves in Romania where we found 58 different species of glowing lichen, and this proves that actually monstrous beasties could have... Right? The press notes for The Descent, Neil Marshall just says, I love horror movies, they're really great, and that's what I wanted to do. What I don't understand is this. Obviously, The Cave was made at the same time as The Descent, so it's not a case of plagiarism. The two things just happened simultaneously. That's unfortunate. The Descent is a great movie. It's a full-on horror movie. It's, you know, limb-ripping and all that sort of stuff, and it's really scary, and it's really claustrophobic, and it's really good fun. The Cave is a 12A movie, and it's, you know, much more complicated, and much more uninteresting, and much more, all the edges have been rounded off it. And of course, it's opening in America now, simultaneously it's opening in England and America. And my only concern about it is, I think The Descent is a film that everyone should see this year. I think if it's a must-see film of the year, I think in the same incidentally about Crash, but you should definitely go and see The Descent. But if you go and see The Cave, you can be put off the idea of going to see cave movies, because The Cave is like, well, you know, fine, you know, monsters, underwater photography, interesting lighting, blah, 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 blah. So, my advice to you is, if The Cave is on at a cinema near you, go and find another cinema that's showing The Descent.
That's not near you.
That's not near you, and go and see The Descent, because The Descent is a proper horror movie, and The Cave is a sort of kiddified, you know, all the nasty edges taken off it, all the interesting ideas taken out of it, version of the same story, and it's a real shame, because, you know, you wait 10 years for a good movie about potholing, and two come at once. And, you know, one of them is great, and one of them is not so great. Has he finished?
This is Five Live from the Royal Opera House, where they occasionally play cricket as well. So we've done a couple of movies. Duke's Hazard, no good. And The Cave, no good. Is there anything that's worth going to see? Because I suspect that you're not going to like Sister of the Travelling Pants.
Well, we do Sister of the Travelling Pants very quickly. It's written by Delia Ephron. A bunch of girls have a summer in which everything changes.
What do you mean everything changes?
You know, it's one of those, after that summer, nothing would ever be the same. You know, you saw Stand By Me. No, it's one of those coming-of-age summers. And they've got a pair of trousers that they send to each other by Federal Express so they can all share in each other's, you know, coming of age things. And it's rubbish. You don't need to know anything about it other than it's rubbish. The short review is pants, because we've only got 6 minutes, so I want to move on. Better, I thought, although crucially flawed, is The Adventures of Shark Boy and Lava Girl in 3D. Now, this is a Robert Rodriguez movie, and he describes it as a Rodriguez family movie. Robert Rodriguez's most recent thing was Sin City, which, of course, is very grown-up, very adult, 18 certificate, and obviously for grown-ups only. This is based on a story or some characters that were dreamt up by his then 7-year-old son, Racer Rodriguez. What would you give to be called Racer Rodriguez?
Not much.
Really?
It's no good.
No? Well, Bruce Willis's son is called what? Satchel? No, that's Woody Allen's son, isn't it? Isn't Bruce Willis called Rummer, baseball cap? Anyway, moving swiftly on, it's basically a story about a guy who's a daydreamer who dreams up these two characters, Shark Boy and Lava Girl. One of them has shark powers, obviously.
Right.
The other one has lava powers.
Well, and what are lava powers?
Well, she's sort of on fire. Her hair is on fire. And
shark powers? What would they be?
He's got sharp teeth, and he's got a fin on his back, and he can swim underwater.
You mean he just dresses up as a shark?
No, he is he's a shark boy. He was raised by sharks, and therefore he has turned into a shark boy. So the kid is a daydreamer. He's an outcast in the real world, but he escapes into his daydreams. Now, the thing that I liked about the film is it's a nicely told story, which is very even-handed for the boys and the girls. There are girl superheroes, which is much more than there is in Fantastic Four. My big problem with the Fantastic Four movies, it doesn't offer any decent role models for the young girls. I mean, it suggests that, you know, men can look like whatever they want to look like, but girls have to look glamorous in order to be superheroes. Shark Boy and Lava Girl, very, very even-handed. But the problem is that what Rodriguez has done is he's done it in 3D. So the movie in the real world is in 2D, but when it goes into the fantasy sequence, it's 3D. Now, 3D has really come a long way recently. with polarizing glasses. And if you go and see an IMAX film in 3D, you know, it's actually quite convincing.
I saw one of those at Universal Studios a couple of weeks ago. They do Shrek in Ogre Vision.
Oh, wow.
Which is absolutely astonishing.
And it'll be polarized,
yep,
right?
Yep. Using all that.
Fine. Well, unfortunately, The Adventures of Sharkboy and Lava Girl in 3D is the old green-red. And the thing about, you know, one, you glasses with a green thing over one eye and a red thing over the other eye. Well, the problem with it is that what happens is you can see out the green eye or the bluey green eye because it's quite clear. The red eye, you can't see anything out of because it's not bright enough. So what happens is rather than getting a fantastic 3D effect is that the whole movie starts to look like a chocolate fudge. And there is some 3D movement within the chocolate fudge, but it's clearly not what you're saying. Every now and then you take the glasses off and you look at the screen in which there's all these dazzling colours, although they're actually out of focus because you haven't got the 3D glasses on. And you put them back on again thinking, this is great, I should be getting fantastic 3D effects. And you think, I'm just watching a chocolate fudge rising and falling slowly in the oven. And I thought it was a real shame. It was a real shame because actually, I thought the movie itself was quite sweet. It's had universally lousy reviews over here. People have said it's got no story, it's got no characters. I don't agree with that. I thought it was an entertaining piece of work, which would have been much better served if he'd just not done the 3D glasses. As it was, I came out with a headache. I couldn't see what was going on properly. And, you know, 3D is a really dodgy thing to get wrong. And I think he really did mess it up rather badly.
Okay, so I just also think that a lot of cinemas are going to mess up the 3D glasses as well. You kind of instinctively think if it's come out in 3D, it needs a gimmick.
Yeah.
It's not good enough without it.
No, well, there are some 3D movies that are, things like, you know, House of Wax, which was a famous 3D movie. There's a 3D print of Kiss Me, Kate. Dial M for Murder was originally done in 3D. Friday the 13th, 3D was great. Andy Warhol's Flesh for Frankenstein, which I think you saw in 3D, didn't you? And that is a fantastic 3D movie. But in the case of Sharkboy and Lava Girl, it would have been much better served by just doing it in 2D. Have I got time to do one more?
Yeah, we'll give you one more minute.
There is a little movie called The Mighty Celt, which is a post-Troubles Irish fable about a young kid who invests all his dreams in a greyhound. And he goes through all manner of emotional elation and trauma as he and this greyhound have this fantastic relationship in which he comes out of his shell and learns about love and life, and while there's this political backdrop going on in the background. Now, obviously, it owes a massive debt to Ken Loach's Kez. The thing about Kez is a very bleak movie, and it's a brilliant movie, and it's very tough and it's very memorable. The Mighty Celt isn't any of those things. It's fairly whimsical, it's fairly flimsy. In the leads, it has Robert Carlyle and Gillian Anderson as the boy's mum, and this sort of returning character that Robert Carlyle plays, who has a mysterious relationship with the boy, which is revealed halfway through the film. And their accents are both very good. Gillian Anderson has got a fantastic way with accents, which is strange, because I thought for ages that she actually was American. When you hear her talking normally, she actually talks like she's from Fry and Barnett.
Movie of the week?
Well, in a very bad week, it's The Mighty Celt.